VOA's International Edition. Coming up, Australian jets conduct the nation's first mission against Islamic State in Iraq. The Hong Kong democracy movement survives into week two. The South Korean president calls for regular talks with the North. The needs of African nations fighting the Ebola outbreak and efforts to help unaccompanied immigrant children facing deportation from the U.S. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. Australian jets have flown their first combat mission over Iraq as part of the international effort to combat Islamic State militants. Australia's Defence Ministry said today that two of its aircraft conducted the mission overnight over northern Iraq, but that neither fired on any targets. The flights come days after the country's cabinet approved deploying fighter aircraft and special forces to Iraq. The Defense Ministry said today it is still waiting on the Iraqi government to approve the special forces to begin advice and assistance operations in Iraq. U.S. forces have conducted weeks of airstrikes in Syria and Iraq against the Islamic State group. Military said Sunday the most recent strikes included destroying tanks and firing on positions in Raqqa and al-Mayadin in Syria, as well as hitting Islamic State targets near Fallujah, hit in Sinjar in Iraq. For the United Nations' perspective on the strategy to deal with the militant group, also known as ISIL, VOA's Carol Castiel, joined by UN correspondent Margaret Bashir, spoke with the UN Deputy Secretary, General Jan Ellison.
The starting point for the United Nations is the fact that this movement, extremist movement, has occupied a part of a sovereign country's territory. And that is a very serious infringement of international law. And leads us to, of course, the clear stand that this occupation of territory on their side must be lifted. We hope that there will be a combination of political measures stemming from, hopefully, a more and more inclusive government in Baghdad and possible other measures which seem to be necessary. And we have, for instance, in the case where the Yazidis were stuck in a mountain area, made the statement from the Secretary General that we welcomed an action which opened up the possibility of reaching them through humanitarian means. And therefore, we hope that this coalition will play a role of a positive nature. But I would also add that it is very important that we combine possible military action with also a diplomatic political strategy.
Indeed, and Deputy Secretary General, you have a lot of experience in Iraq, in Iran, certainly in the region. In terms of this political solution, particularly in Iraq, are you optimistic that this can take place soon enough for a change or for a shift in order to combat this Daesh threat, the threat from ISIL?
I cannot be sure. I only want to make the point that it is necessary to pursue the two paths in parallel. I know the dangers coming from this movement. Not only have they taken large parts of the north part of the Iraq, but they are also very close now to Baghdad. So it is a clear danger. The signs from the new government are positive. But unfortunately, there has been a long period of alienation and frustration felt by the Sunni community. And for the attentions of the new government under al-Abadi, for that to reach out to the local communities is probably a longer process. But I hope that they will send those signals clearly so that we can see results very soon in terms of growing support from the Sunni community to realize that the gravest danger for Iraq stems from ISIL or Daesh.
A question from Margaret.
Deputy Secretary General, the day after the United States began the airstrikes in Syria, Secretary General Ban Ki-moon made some remarks about them, and he appeared to sort of give his blessing to it. Does the UN believe there's an adequate legal basis for it? He was mentioning that the strikes took place in parts of Syria that were not under the government's control and that there were humanitarian issues. So is that the UN's way of saying that there is an adequate legal basis for it, because Syria did not invite us in to do it like Iraq did?
Well, I must admit that, of course, the international legal case is more difficult to make when it comes to entering another territory, another country's territory. On the other hand, there are very clear Security Council resolutions and decisions taken on dealing with the ISIL threat. And the fact is still that the territory has been taken by this movement from an independent country, and that this independent country is asking for assistance from not least the United States and the coalition. So I would just think that we should hopefully have signals from the Security Council that this action is acceptable. The session that was held under President Obama on foreign fighters was a positive sign that this is seen as a universal threat. And if the Security Council accepts this as an action in line with the principles of the United Nations, we would be very happy to welcome that. There is also a discussion, which is not to me completely clear, whether there is information passed on to the Syrian authorities about the actions taken.
Jan Ellison is the UN Deputy Secretary General. He spoke with Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Press Conference USA, and UN correspondent Margaret Bashir. You can hear more of their conversation by going to our website, voanews.com, and look under the Programs tab for Press Conference USA. Hong Kong protesters ignored the government's ultimatum to quit their occupation of the Central Business District for the start of the work week today, but they created pathways allowing workers to reach their offices. After the night passed and riot police did not try to forcibly remove the demonstrators before dawn, as some feared, the number of demonstrators again ebbed as the day began. Ivan Broadhead reports from the streets of Hong Kong.
As the sun rose over Hong Kong Monday morning, an incredulous cheer spread among the hundreds of students who had slept the night on the financial district's streets. Just a week after riot police fired tens of tear gas canisters at the democracy activists, many were unsure the campaign would get this far. A recently awoken Jane Chow, 27, is one of those. She remains sceptical about the government's intentions and expects riot police to use force to evict the protesters in the coming days.
That's very likely to happen, yes. And if they're smart, they won't do it in a way that's overly violent. So even if the government tries to clear out the protests, I don't think that at least on the side of the protesters there will be any violence.
Demonstrators say they believe the reason Hong Kong's chief executive did not send out forces to clear the streets is because student leaders met one of the leaders' two conditions for negotiations to begin, allowing civil servants back into the central government office complex. By 9 o'clock, hundreds of functionaries were flowing out of the nearby metro station to their office, with student marshals ensuring them a clear path. This lady, who refused to give her name, was unimpressed. She berated the activists for not allowing workers to resume their duties sooner. The elderly government cleaner complained the students do not realize that these are hard times and that she and other government workers have jobs to do and livelihoods to protect. Overseeing the marshals, Lam Ming concedes it might be increasingly hard for the movement to maintain community support. He insists, however, that the activists have not made too many concessions to Hong Kong leader Leung Chun-ying, with nothing to show in return.
You can say we concede quite substantially, letting civil servants come to work. It is their responsibility to maybe giving way in on the negotiation table. I don't think in the foreseeable future that the protesters would be willing to concede the role.
Not all is back to normal in Hong Kong. Schools and businesses remain closed, and demonstrators, whose numbers rise and fall throughout each day, say they will remain in the streets until Chief Executive Leung Chun-ying resigns and the authorities allow free elections. For now, neither side is willing to back down in a continuing political brinksmanship that is being closely watched around the world. Ivan Broadhead for VOA News, Hong Kong.
The visit to South Korea of the highest-level North Korean delegation in 5 years is generating hope for a thaw in the frosty relationship that has blanketed the divided peninsula for decades. South Korea's president is among those expressing such a desire. VOA correspondent Steve Herman reports from Bangkok.
South Korean President Park Geun-hye is calling for regular talks between Seoul and Pyongyang. The comment to her senior aides Monday follows a sudden and rare visit to the South by top North Korean officials. President Park says efforts should be made to ensure that the upcoming high-level talks will pave a way for peaceful reunification by holding regular inter-Korean dialogue, not just a one-time dialogue. The president's remarks follow Saturday's half-day discussion between officials of the South and North held in the port city of Incheon. The 11-member North Korean delegation was led by the vice chairman of the powerful National Defense Commission. Vice Marshal Hwang Pyong-so is considered by analysts to have recently become the second most powerful figure in North Korea, behind leader Kim Jong-un. South Korean officials have acknowledged they were caught by surprise when the North Koreans contacted them Friday about meeting in the South on Saturday, the same day as the closing ceremony of the Asian Games. Both Koreas had separate delegations participating in the athletic event. The senior rank of those who flew to Incheon was interpreted as a signal the North Koreans wanted to achieve more than merely attending a sports ceremony, and the Saturday talks appear to have cleared a path towards a possible summit. In Seoul, Unification Ministry spokesman Im Byung-chul says authorities have not yet agreed on the agenda for reviving high-level talks late this month or early November. Im tells reporters the issue of families divided on the peninsula is the most important one to be resolved, and the South believes it is necessary to raise that matter. The last high-level talks with the North occurred in February. The resumption of direct contacts between Seoul and Pyongyang comes at a time of considerable speculation about the well-being of the North's leader. Mr. Kim, in his early 30s, has not appeared in public for more than a month, his longest period out of sight since succeeding his father, who died in 2011. In the most recent video news clips released by state media, he is seen limping. He also has gained considerable weight since taking over what is considered the world's only hereditary communist dynasty. Some analysts and sources in the intelligence community believe Mr. Kim may be out of the spotlight to recover from some type of leg surgery. Officials in Seoul say a member of the North's visiting delegation Saturday assured them Mr. Kim has no health-related issues. Im Jae-chun is a professor of North Korean studies at Korea University in Seoul.
Kim Jong-un's power is stable, although he's sick. North Korea might want to send a message to outside world. Kim Jong-un is in control, and he was the man who sent the power elites as his delegates.
The professor says, however, the early optimism that this will lead to a major breakthrough should be tempered.
There should be give and take to make an agreement between the two Koreas. It's too early to predict what and how much each side can give to each partner at this moment, so we need to wait and see.
The two Koreas technically remain at war. An armistice was signed in 1953, halting hostilities after nearly 3 years of combat that also involved U.S.-led U.N. forces fighting the Chinese. South Korea was not a signatory to the armistice. Relations have remained chilled through the decades, with sporadic acts of violence, especially along the border. Steve Herman, VOA News, Bangkok.
Ebola has killed about 3,500 people in West Africa since the outbreak began last year. Guinea, Liberia, and Sierra Leone are the hardest hit countries. There is one known person believed to have developed the disease while in the United States. A Liberian-born man, now in the state of Texas, is said to be fighting for his life at a Dallas hospital. Dr. Thomas Frieden, chief of the Centers for Disease Control, spoke with NBC's Matt Lauer about patient Thomas Duncan.
Our hopes and prayers are with him, and we recognize that this is a critical time for him and for his family. This is the time when we're particularly looking at the contacts that he had. 10 contacts who definitely had contact with him, and 38 others who might have had contact, Every single one of those 48 people was monitored yesterday. The temperatures were taken. None of them had symptoms. None of them had fever. The key here is to keep doing that every single day, as Texas is doing excellently. Have fever, isolate them to stop the transmission.
When you say isolate them, I just want to make sure we're clear on this. Are they being called every day and said and being told, are you taking your temperature? Or is there someone watching these people to make sure they don't inadvertently slip out of their homes and expose other people?
Their temperatures are being taken directly by outreach staff from health departments in Texas. In addition, their locations are known, and if any of them might slip out, as you put it, that's being addressed appropriately by authorities in Texas.
As you know, there's an American photojournalist, Ashoka Mukpa, or Mukpa, excuse me, who's arriving in Nebraska today for treatment. How closely will the CDC work with that health center there?
Very closely. We've worked with them already. We consult with their clinicians about the care of the patient. We've already been doing that on the way over. And we'll also make sure that the doctors and nurses and whole team taking care of him does that in a way that doesn't put them at risk by providing them with support.
And just quickly now, if we can, officials in this country have had a chance to get their hands on and observe closely several people infected with this Ebola virus right now. Has that work led us any closer to a vaccine? And something else we haven't heard about in several weeks, Dr. Frieden, ZMapp, that experimental serum that was given to at least two of the patients. Is there any more on that? Is it any more promising in your opinion?
We don't know if ZMapp works, but there's no more of it now. The company is working hard to make a few more doses, but it's hard to make. It takes a long time. We have learned how very important fluid and electrolyte management is. Rehydration of patients can be life-saving, and that's something that we're taking back to Africa to try to improve the care there, to improve the rehydration of patients, because that'll make a difference. And, you know, we are seeing signs of progress. CDC has now trained more than 4,000 health workers in Africa. We're training health workers in this country. We're seeing people from all over the world come to help out in Africa. We've seen the exit screening identify 77 people and get them off the planes in Africa. So I think we are definitely seeing signs of progress.
Dr. Thomas Frieden, chief of the Centers for Disease Control, speaking with NBC's Matt Lauer on the Today program. A U.S. African forum in Washington discussed the immediate needs of the African countries fighting Ebola. VOA's Latika Hoke attended the meeting recently.
Delegates from the meeting at the African Union mission in Washington stressed that Ebola is a global problem and that every nation has a role in helping bring it to an end. Sierra Leone Ambassador to the United States, Pokari Stevens, said Western countries have pledged to send medical experts and material support to fight the disease in West Africa, but it has taken some time to arrive.
The British promised to build a 700-bed hospital. That has not been done yet, but they have started construction. The Cubans went yesterday, 165 Cubans landed in Cuban doctors landed in Sierra Leone. We think with all of those efforts now being marshaled together, we should be able to see some light at the end of the tunnel.
Ambassador Stevens said efforts in his country have not stopped Ebola's destructive path. He said 18 more people died from the virus on the streets of Freetown on Thursday. But he said the Sierra Leonean diaspora has been helpful.
In fact, we have diasporas who are volunteering, especially diasporas in the medical field, nurses, paramedics, and doctors. Some of them are volunteers. Some of them are in Freetown now, in Sierra Leone now, helping with the training and motivating our other local health workers.
The ambassador called Ebola the world's biggest terrorist, but said with enough international support, it could be defeated. A delegate from Zimbabwe, Emmanuel Nadozi, urged a vigorous response by the international community to Ebola and other problems in West Africa.
Because after Ebola, there will be need to also deal with the consequences of Ebola. There will be need to build strong institutions to prevent such a crisis from happening again.
Representatives of the most affected countries stressed the importance of solidarity in the fight against Ebola. Chinua Akukwe, chairman of the National Academy of Public Administration in Washington, said the spread of Ebola outside Africa shows that the world cannot ignore the problem.
In the Congress, I had called for a new public public-private international partnership to deal with the Ebola with the immediate and long-term goal of rebuilding health systems in Africa.
Participants at the forum said that containing Ebola is only the first step in helping Liberia, Sierra Leone, and Guinea recover from the disease. The three countries will also need help to put education, agriculture, business, and industrial sector back on track after suffering losses in the current outbreak. Their ability to prevent another health disaster in the future may depend on how well they rebuild after this one. Larissa Ho, VOA News, Washington.
China is a fascinating country.
With interesting people doing amazing things.
Every Friday, we focus attention on some of our favorite things coming out of China during the previous week.
It may be political, it may be cultural.
It may simply be a curiosity that caught our attention.
But we'll find stories sure to be of interest.
And then, of course, we'll add our own, American perspectives as well.
I'm Sarah Williams.
I'm Jim Stevenson.
Join us for China Focus every Friday at 12 hours Universal Time on VOA Radio.
And anytime on the web at voanews.com and on Facebook VOA Asia.
New York is a popular destination for immigrants seeking protection from violence, political oppression, or poverty back home. But over the past decade, as gangland violence has escalated in Central America, U.S. immigration courts have become overwhelmed by the number of immigrants seeking refuge. Tens of thousands are unaccompanied children who often lack lawyers or advocates during their deportation hearings. VOA's Adam Phillips attended a free, state-sponsored training workshop for those who want to help.
Several dozen people were attending an intensive two-day training at New York Law School recently. It will help qualify them to represent immigrants at New York's federal immigration courts, which are among the nation's busiest. Attorney Camille Mackler of the New York Immigration Coalition was the workshop instructor. She explained why the training is necessary for lawyers and lay advocates alike.
Right now, there's about 50,000 cases pending in front of the New York City Immigration Court. The average length of a case is 4 years from start to finish, just because the judges are so busy and immigration courts are so underfunded that there just aren't the resources to meet the number of people on there.
Mackler acknowledges that immigrants, especially child immigrants, might welcome the chance to stay in New York for 4 years while waiting for their hearing.
Well, yes, but you need to know that you have a case that you can apply for. Because if you just go in front of the judge and you don't realize that you're entitled, and these children, 80% of them are entitled to some form of relief under the laws that exist today, but they don't know that. I mean, it takes somebody trained in this area to know and to be able to get that case going for those 4 years.
Nigerian-born Ulubumi Segun, who received her law degree in England, hopes the workshops will help her gain competence and reduce stress for her and her clients.
There's so many people who've been here for years. Home is here now. And it's difficult for them to imagine being shipped off back to a country, even though they were born there, but they haven't lived there for years. They've had kids here, they've become acclimatized. And when you step into immigration court and you know that they trust you, and I feel a lot of pressure, as in I have to deliver. And that's why I'm here, to understand the little bits and tricks, or how best you can diligently assist them and ensure that they get to remain here.
Fellow trainee Abir Alharazi is a lay immigrant caseworker for the Arab American Association of New York, a grassroots nonprofit organization. Abir says she wants to help others avoid the demoralizing uncertainty she underwent for 10 years, beginning in 2001 when she emigrated from Yemen.
You cannot work, you cannot go to jobs, you can't establish your life, you know, and that could lead you to go to the dark sides of your life.
There are many other reasons why lawyers and laypersons take immigration advocacy training. Some see it as a social justice issue. They say everyone should be given adequate representation in court. If an immigrant cannot afford an advocate themselves, the state should provide one. One woman who works for a social services agency wants to help her HIV-positive clients get their deportation orders deferred if they're unable to obtain or afford AIDS medication back home. Either way, the training will continue, if only because the tide of immigrants seeking to live in the U.S. will almost certainly continue to rise, and with it, the strain both on the courts and on individuals hoping to start a new life in America. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On October 6, 1539, Spanish conquistador Hernando de Soto and his army entered the Apalache capital of Anhaica by force. Anhaica was located at the site of Tallahassee, that's the present-day capital of Florida. On this day in 1889, in Paris, the Moulin Rouge opened its doors to the public for the first time. It's known for its then-decadent can-can girls. In 1908, Austria-Hungary annexed Bosnia-Herzegovina from the Ottoman Empire. That action increased distrust among the governments in Europe and led to an arms buildup. This is believed to be a major step toward the World War that erupted 6 years later. In 1927, the movie The Jazz Singer opened. It was the first full-length film to feature the voices of its actors, marking the commercial rise of talkies and the decline of silent movies. On this day in 1976, Chinese Premier Hua Guofeng ordered the arrest of the notorious Gang of Four and their associates, thus ending the time of chaos known as the Cultural Revolution. In 1981, Egyptian President Anwar el-Sadat was assassinated at a military rally in Cairo. Sadat became a target for Islamic extremists after negotiating a peace treaty with Israel. In 2000, Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic resigned from office, admitting defeat in national elections the month before. Milosevic espoused a brand of Serb nationalism that led to military aggression against the country's neighbors. He was put on trial for war crimes, but died before the court reached its verdict. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
As world leaders met last month in New York for the opening of the 69th session of the United Nations General Assembly, the United States worked to focus greater attention and pressure toward ending the political crisis in South Sudan. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called a September 25th high-level meeting to discuss the dire humanitarian crisis caused by the conflict there and the growing frustration in the international community that despite President Salva Kiir's and former Vice President Riek Machar's recommitment to cease hostilities, fighting continues. Even as the parties resumed national unity talks in Ethiopia, mediated by the Intergovernmental Authority on Development, or IGAD, government troops and opposition forces loyal to the former vice president clashed again in Upper Nile State, leaving almost 200 dead. U.S. officials taking part in the UN meeting told participants that the fighting has driven 1.8 million people, close to 20% of the population, from their homes, almost 500,000 of them into refugee camps in neighboring nations. Some 40% of South Sudanese are in need of food assistance, all in a man-made crisis that can only be settled through inclusive peace talks, not on the battlefield. Ambassador Donald Booth is U.S. Special Envoy to Sudan and South Sudan.
We urge that everyone who has been party to the talks to date, whether the political parties, civil society, the religious communities, be allowed to continue to participate in the negotiations.
Fighting erupted in December 2013 when a political dispute within the country's ruling party, the Sudan People's Liberation Movement, turned violent. Political conflict erupted into intercommunal fighting with a cost of more than 10,000 lives. The United States and international community are putting pressure on the warring parties in other ways as well. The United States has imposed sanctions on individuals from both sides of the conflict who are responsible for gross violations of human rights or violations of the cessation of hostilities agreement. More may be imposed. Again, Ambassador Booth.
We will continue to look with our Troika EU partners and IGAD, other ways of increasing the costs of continuing the conflict as a way of pressuring the parties to negotiate seriously.
The United States is fully supportive of the IGAD mediation effort and stands with the people of South Sudan. President Salva Kiir and Riek Machar must assume their responsibilities to prevent further needless suffering.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.